The New Testament lesson comes from Acts 2, 1 through 21. It's on page 119 in the New Testament in your pew Bible. When the day of Pentecost came, they were all together in one place. Suddenly a sound like the blowing of a violent wind came from heaven and filled the whole house where they were sitting. They saw what seemed to be tongues of fire that separated and came to rest on each of them. All of them were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other tongues as the Spirit enabled them. Now there were staying in Jerusalem God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven. When they heard this sound, a crowd came together in bewilderment, because each one heard their own language being spoken. Utterly amazed, they asked, "Aren't all these who are speaking Galileans? Then how is it that each of us hears them in our native language? Parthians, Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and parts of Libya near Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and converts to Judaism, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues." Amazed and perplexed, they asked one another, "What does this mean?" Some, however, made fun of them and said, "They've had too much wine." Then Peter stood up with the 11, raised his voice, and addressed the crowd. "Fellow Jews, and all of you who live in Jerusalem, let me explain this to you. Listen carefully to what I say. These people are not drunk as you suppose. It's only 9 in the morning. No, this is what was spoken by the prophet Joel. In the last days, God says, I will pour out my spirit on all people. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your young men will see visions. Your old men will dream dreams. Even on my servants, both men and women, I will pour out my spirit in those days, and they will prophesy. I will show wonders in the heavens above and signs on the earth below, blood and fire and billows of smoke. The sun will be turned to darkness and the moon to blood before the coming of the great and glorious day of the Lord. And everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved."
Now may the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our rock and our redeemer. What an insult. They called them drunk. It was a moment they had waited for, when heaven and earth would meet. Their deepest spiritual longings would begin to be realized, and the Spirit of God would take up residence among them and within them. That very day, God's mission on earth would be passed into their hands, and they would become the mothers and fathers of the greatest religious and social movement ever known to humanity. Pentecost. It all made them positively giddy. We're told that they began to speak in one another's native languages. But we shouldn't imagine in those languages some sort of civilized, courtly conversation. No, there would have been some sort of multi-ethnic whooping and hollering going on. Some sort of bilingual or trilingual or polylingual cheering. There must have been some wild and celebratory stuff going on. Because some who had gathered around them looked on to whatever was happening and concluded that to act like that, "You must be drunk." To say it as Luke did, they were accused of being filled with new wine. How embarrassing. The very first day that the church was an actual thing. Inauguration day, moment one, the church's coming out party. From the very beginning, our mothers and fathers in faith were being accused of public intoxication. I don't know about you, but that's not the image of any organization I'd like to be a part of. I certainly don't like to think of it as the story of the origin of my primary association in life, the church. I know that I'm Baptist and that I'm from the South, but I'm not worried about this image of drunkenness on moral grounds, as you may have guessed. Yes, Baptists, along with our Methodist siblings, sold out to the cause of prohibition, but that was a long time ago. And I know they say really good Baptists, according to the church of my youth, don't drink. I even know that marginally good Baptists aren't supposed to drink in public. If you need a biblical proof text to make a case against drinking, I can give them to you. "Do not be drunk on wine," says Paul. The wine that Jesus drank, it wasn't really alcohol. So on, so forth. Now, I'm not really buying all of that, but I still don't want the church, that organization who nurtured me to adulthood, the community in whom I find my closest friends, that messy little conglomerate of the faithful along whom I hope for the salvation of the world, I still don't want them associated with public drunkenness because it just looks so irresponsible, so reckless. It looks undignified, and I don't want to be associated with that. You see, when I picture the church, I imagine sophistication and responsibility. I can see in my mind's eye men and women coming together around a table in sort of professional, or at least semi-professional dress, and discussing in an orderly fashion the vision and mission of the congregation. I see well-organized and highly motivated people meeting with officials and offering well-structured, eloquent arguments calling for real justice for all. If I closed my eyes, I'd be able to see them gathered in worship, sitting in the neat rows, greeting one another formulaically, "Peace of Christ be with you and also with you," and so on. I could see them singing together from a collection of hymns assembled by people on committees and subcommittees and adopted by congregational vote. This is the church I want to be a part of: orderly, responsible, respectable, sober. Doesn't that sound nice? A body of believers with an orderly system of decision-making committed to using their resources in the service of the mission of God on earth. That's what the church was born to be, not these crazy, seemingly drunken fools we read about in Acts. In fact, I dare say that we do a lot of what we do as a church these days for the express purpose of avoiding accusations of inebriation. Think on that for a moment. Aside from the obsession of some Baptists in America for the last century with the actual consumption of alcohol, we do a lot more to avoid being perceived as under the influence. See, when you're intoxicated, your tongue seems to loosen a little bit. So I hear. One could bring a lot of trouble on oneself by becoming willing to say things in public that otherwise one would probably self-censor. The church and various parts unto have avoided such trouble in the past by simply keeping our mouths shut. That's why the Southern Baptist Convention waited 150 years to apologize for their role in American slavery, ratifying a resolution of apology in 1995. That's why we still stand at the cusp of great social change toward more radical inclusion and acceptance of people who do not fit the norm where it pertains to gender or sexuality, but convince ourselves that we have no, that we need no voice in the matter. To go around like a loose cannon blurting out how our culture has gone wrong and hurt people. To go around shouting about how we, the church, have hurt people. To do a thing like that, you'd have to be drunk. To willingly and intentionally put life, limb, and reputation in harm's way on behalf of others who we don't even know. You'd have to be drunk to do a thing like that. And we have to keep our wits about us. Those under the influence of new wine tend to display low regard for self-preservation. They become bold and daring to the point of risking injury or loss. They'll not just say anything, they'll do anything. Anyone who's ever worked in the hospitality industry knows that those who have had a couple are typically more forthcoming with tips. Their lightened concern for self-preservation makes them more generous. We can't be like that, can we? We can't afford to be the kind of people who run around town with $100 bills flapping in the wind, saying, "What can we do with these? What can we do with these?" Something bad could happen. We could end up with a reputation doing things like that. What would we do, First Baptist, if after 200 years we became known as the kind of people who go freewheeling it all over town, caring not for our own well-being, taking risks, saying, proclaiming things that make people blush? What would we do? The gospel, of course. See, proclaiming the upside down, last is first is last, poor get richer get poorer, weakness is power, power is weakness, and death leads to life message of Jesus is crazy talk to most onlookers. It requires putting life, limb, and reputation on the line. It includes making decisions that seem counterintuitive. It does not remain within the decorousness and orderliness of life, and it never has. Thanks be to God, though, from the very beginning, the church has been doing things in service of God that got them accused of being drunk. And that's a wonderful tradition, if you ask me. See, Peter stood up to let the crowd witnessing these first church members in their ecstasy know that they were not drunk. But when Peter stood up to defend them, his goal was not to defend their honor. The church, and let's make careful note here. The church, in its best form, has never bothered much with defending its own honor. No, Peter was concerned instead with letting people see what was really happening. All this ecstasy, all this swapping of languages, all this inclusion and reorientation of priorities, all this stuff that was happening that first day of existence of the church was not due to too much wine. It was due to the presence of God's Spirit among them. But you can see their confusion, can't you? You see, too much wine will cause you to say things that are a little crazy. But so will an indwelling of the Spirit of God. Getting yourself a little bit tipsy might cause you to get your priorities all out of order. But so too will the Spirit of God. Too much of Grandpa's old cough medicine will make you act a little bit reckless sometimes. But so will the Spirit of God. I'm a little bit jealous of Peter here, actually. See, he was the leader of that first group of misfit believers to join together as the church. And he recognized that it was no shame for the people he led to be mistaken for drunk. No, indeed, it was an honor. I would love to have the opportunity to stand before an assembly of those looking at the actions and decisions of my little branch of the church, First Baptist, and say, I know they seem drunk, but they're not. And you know what? I believe that I may very well have that opportunity. Because if you, First Baptist, continue on the path you're on, I might get that chance. If you believe that the Spirit of God is truly present in and working through a people like us, if you keep making decisions that pay very little attention to institutional survival or sound business practice, if you keep loving radically and keep including even beyond what feels comfortable, sometimes even what's right, if you keep doing all of this, I may very well get a chance to defend you, because to do all that, you'd have to be drunk. Amen.